netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk with Dan Lemon, Weta's VFX supervisor for Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Mike caught up with Dan while Dan was in New York for the premiere of the film. The rest of the FX Guide crew, Mike Seymour, John Montgomery, Matt Graham, and Ian Fales are all should be just about arriving home now from SIGGRAPH in Vancouver. Great show that I couldn't attend this year, but the guys did amazing coverage. There's a lot of stories from every day at the show and podcasts and FX Guide TV episodes. So check that out. And this podcast is kind of an example of why we love SIGGRAPH so much. We get so much content and so much ideas for what we do throughout the year at shows like SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH is kind of special. We cover IBC, multiple SIGGRAPHs, NAB, but SIGGRAPH just, we see stuff there that so often a few years down the line becomes common tools. Like if you've been following stories and FX Guide TV episodes and podcasts, we've been talking off and on over the last couple of years about deep compositing, really watching the evolution. And now you're seeing that deep compositing being used more and more in films, talked about in podcasts as being used in real life situations and rolling into tools like Nuke, where they're supporting deep compositing now, and people really liking the advantages that something like that can bring. So it's one of the reasons we chase these shows so relentlessly, is really keeping in touch with the manufacturers and the researchers and people working on these new tools. In fact, in this podcast, if you've been following a lot of the FX Guide and FX PhD stuff, in Background Fundamentals this term, Mike did a class with Dennis Muren talking about HDR. And one of the things he talked about was how important the eyes are and often need special lighting that maybe doesn't work as well from an HDR, that the character's eyes, especially these heavy CG films, the character's eyes are so important to the character and making the character work. Dennis and Mike talked quite a bit about that, and Dennis told a great story. If you haven't seen that class, I recommend it over at fxphd.com. It's part of our Background Fundamentals course that everybody gets when they sign up. You'll hear Dan talk about how much attention they paid to the eyes for the apes, which makes a lot of sense. All right, so let's just jump into this. Mike Seymour is going to talk now with Dan Lemon, Weta VFX supervisor for Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
So what I was wanting to do, if I could, I wanted to talk to you about the film in general, but I wanted to specifically talk to you about, well, the eyes, actually. So maybe we might start with the sort of general film first. And one of the things that struck me was amazing about this film is that just how much you expanded the motion capture volume and the idea of doing it in an external environment. Was that always on the cards from early on, or did you sort of move to that point?
It was definitely like a part of our initial conversations. We read the scripts and we sort of looked at what the film was going to be, and we realized that it was really going to be necessary that Caesar and as well as the rest of the apes, but especially Caesar, interact with the human actors as much as possible. And so the best way to do that is to take the motion capture volume and move it to the production stage. And so we kind of set about trying to figure out what the best way to do that was. And because of the nature of the script, some of the sets were on a stage and some of the sets were on location out in sunlight in some cases. So we kind of rethought our whole kind of performance capture hardware and software package and tried to figure out the best way to condense it down into a smaller footprint. So we looked at kind of trying to get by with a minimum amount of cameras, and also looked at upgrading our market technology so that we could use it in a higher ambient light level. And the way we did that was we took LED strands, really bright infrared LEDs, and attached them to the actors' bodies. So rather than relying on the bodies to reflect light back to the motion capture cameras, we actually generated the light on their bodies. And by doing that, we were able to get a much higher contrast ratio and kind of punch through the ambient sunlight. So by doing that, we were able to actually shoot out in broad daylight, full sun, and still get really good data. The other thing we did was we tried to configure things in such a way that the act of setting up and calibrating a motion capture volume was a lot faster. So we had a set of kind of mobile trusses that had crossbars on them, and we'd pair the cameras up in twos, which would pre-calibrate them on those mobile towers and then roll them into position for a particular camera setup and wave a wand out in front of them, basically a calibration stick, and lock that space down. And then when they would move the camera, the motion picture camera around for the next setup, we'd roll the towers to the next location, kind of quickly wave the wand and get a calibration. But it was much faster than, you know, what we would normally do with an initial calibration for a traditional kind of mocap space.
I mean, it seemed the other thing is that you had quite a lot of targeted character or actors in the scene in suits. So it wasn't just a matter of capturing like maybe one or two, but there seemed to be like a lot from what I've seen in the behind the scenes footage at once being captured. And I'm just wondering how clean the data was, because there were so many individuals to be isolated, and then there was other props, other actors, other things causing problems, obscuring lines to sort of things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a challenge. Obviously, the more guys you put in the volume, and the more objects you have sort of interfering with, occluding or obscuring the performers, the more holes you're going to get. But we built enough suits to be able to capture eight performers at a time, and certainly the volumes we were building were big enough to accommodate that. Like you mentioned, the challenge was just the number of occluding factors that would, you know, things that would get in the way of those actors. We were fortunate to be able to use Giant motion capture software, and Giant does a really good job of handling marker dropouts and kind of interpolating through areas where, you know, there may be sections where the data isn't as clean, and it handles that sort of thing pretty well. So that was helpful also.
Normally on a motion capture stage, you don't have tons of light pouring down like you would in an exterior. And in particular, I was wondering whether you had problems with reflections, because there were cars or whatever other props there that were shiny in high sun. I imagine that you would literally get bounce from the sensors. Is that true, or is that a naive question?
Nope, you're absolutely right. And so what we would do is we went through a process. You know, when we'd set up for the next setup, we'd roll the cameras into position, and things like hubcaps or cars occasionally, you get pretty bright kicks. And we had a process where we'd just go in and mask those areas out of a particular camera view. So we'd kind of bounce between different cameras and draw a little box and isolate a section, say, tell the camera basically, ignore this big bright patch, you know, at this X and Y location. And it's the kind of thing where if we weren't, because of time constraints, if we weren't able to do all of the cameras, get them all totally cleaned up on the day, we could capture in such a way that we could go back later when we were processing the data and clean that stuff up after the fact.
And what about the
retargeting? Basically go in and mask afterwards.
What about the retargeting? Because obviously chimpanzees, gorillas, whatever, are close to humans in terms of bipeds, but they're not the same in proportions. I mean, obviously, the arms tend to be longer in an ape than in a human, and they obviously, apart from the actual motion, they physically don't have the joints in exactly the same place. So how was the retargeting something that you'd done any more work on from earlier productions?
Yeah, Mike, you're absolutely right. The proportions are, I mean, while they're similar in some ways, they're quite different in a lot of other ways, and definitely the arm length is a big thing. Chimpanzees certainly have, you know, their arms are about, in proportions, you know, they're about a foot longer than humans, and orangutans are much, much longer. They have almost tiny legs compared to the length of their arms. So that was definitely something that we had to accommodate. So one of the things we used, and we'd done a little bit of it on King Kong, but we used it to a lot greater extent on Rise of the Apes, was we would put the actors in arm extensions, basically like little crutches that they would wear that would extend their arms about, you know, a foot to the or anywhere from between a foot and a foot and a half, to make them longer in proportion to the rest of their body, and that would give them that allow them to get into a position, especially when they're kind of walking quadrupedally, to where the relationship between their shoulders and their hips was a lot closer to what it would be with a chimpanzee, and you know that at least got the kind of rough broad strokes of the gait in the place. And then we'd go back in and set some retargeting values for, you know, for the different animals that they would be mapping onto, and also for the different positions as well. So, like, when the chimpanzee is walking quadrupedally, we'd use one set of retargeting values, but when the chimpanzee would be walking bipedally, we'd change it. And especially when they'd sit down, if we didn't change the, you know, the parameters for the retargeting, when they'd sit down, their bums would end up dropping through the floor. So we set up some things so they would kind of automatically adjust as they kind of moved into their different positions. It would makes more sense based on what the chimpanzee was actually doing. And then, of course, a lot of times we would take the arm extensions off as well because they would be needing to use, you know, actually interact with things with their hands. And in those cases, you know, we would just have to go in and essentially manually retarget some of that motion so that to accommodate those longer arms.
You talk about them handling things with their hands. When they're actually interacting with live-action actors, obviously you've got a problem of having a digital hand line up with the actor's hand, and even with the best will in the world, there's going to be issues there. Were there occasions where you decided to replace the if you like, human actor's hands in addition to replacing the motion capture actor's hands to get all those interactions with objects and stuff to work really well?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, there were probably about four or five shots in the film where we replaced James Franco's hands with digital hands, and it's not something that we've actually talked much about. But it's very astute of you to recognize that challenge, and that's definitely something that we ran into. And in some cases, like you kind of inferred, it's actually easier to just replace the human actor's hands and get better contact and better interaction than to try to use the real actor's physical hand.
The rig that Andy Serkis was wearing, in particular, obviously playing Caesar, involved a helmet camera that sort of came out from the side of his head with a camera. I was wondering, firstly, is that a mono camera, and how did that camera facial capture system sort of alter significantly from, for example, what was done on Avatar?
So that camera was in fact a mono camera. It was just a single camera kind of mounted center to his face and centered up and, not stereo, just getting two-dimensional X and Y kind of movements of the markers on his face. And it was essentially using a system very similar to the Avatar system, the main difference being just that we were using it to map, to a chimpanzee face, which had, you know, fairly different anatomical structure than, say, the Jake's Avatar face, which was actually reasonably close in most ways to Sam Worthington's face. So but the kind of core technology was very similar in that we were taking the two-dimensional movements on in screen space of those dots and sort of extrapolating a three-dimensional component to them and processing that to derive higher level fax shapes using the kind of the Bruckman facial action coding system, figuring out what the dot movements meant in terms of actual muscles firing.
Yeah, because that system basically goes through an intermediate database, doesn't it? So it's not just a matter of a literal movement, it's an interpretation of the movement.
That's right. It goes through a database, and then it also goes through fairly significant human control as well, where it's not just an automatic process. There are operators that are using the data and running solves on it and evaluating whether those solves are correct or not, and then tweaking parameters and rerunning those solves again to arrive at the most accurate recreation of what the performer was actually doing.
Now, this is a film with its, you know, action sequences. There are people or other apes jumping at helicopters. There's all sorts of stuff. But ever since the first trailer, the thing that struck me about your work that was just jaw-dropping was the level of performance you seem to be getting from Caesar's eyes. Because up until near the end of the film, he doesn't really talk. And the thing about it is that, you know, it's easy to think about motion capture and all this kind of stuff, but the last thing in the world motion capture is giving you is an eye performance, not least of which because I presume Andy Serkis hasn't got special contact lenses in, and even if he did, it's not about that. Can you talk to me about that idea of the performance through the eyes? Because it just struck me as just really impressive, but also incredibly central to the success of the film, that we could believe that Caesar was thinking.
Yeah, thanks. That's really nice to hear. Yeah, definitely. We knew the eyes were going to be a challenge, and it's something that we've put a lot of time and effort into in the past. And definitely, this film being a largely silent film where the main character doesn't speak much but has to communicate a lot emotionally. We knew the eyes were going to be really important. And if the audience was going to buy that it's a living, breathing, thinking creature, we had to really sell it. So we took all the work that we've done on the Avatar eyes, and we took it a step further. Basically, we kind of went in and rebuilt the way that we structured and configured the eyes, added additional geometry and additional kind of levels of in terms of the surfacing and the kind of fluid deformation between the the various surfaces and the way they interface with the moisture in the eye. We actually, there's a buddy of mine back in Wellington who I spent a lot of time sailing with over the years, who's an eye surgeon, and he offered to let us into his shop, and a bunch of us went down there, and he kind of showed us a lot of sort of kind of specific eye anatomy things, and we put dye in some of our guys' eyes and looked at them under his scopes, and did some experiments in terms of like blinking and seeing how the meniscus changes over over time after you do a blink and how the moisture changes. And I took some measurements in terms of the amount of specularity, the reflection off the eyes, and just tried to get as much physical and anatomical detail as we could, and just take everything just a bit further than we had been able to take it before.
I mean, that would, I feel, sort of feed into, you know, how you were doing it from a rendering shading point of view. But I was just curious, in terms of like animation, how far did you have to go to get the performance? I mean, were you animating just the eyelids, or how far into the face, if you know what I mean, did you have to go to get that to be a performance that kind of worked, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that we do when we're kind of taking the data from the face capture camera. We take a lot of the raw data from the eye tracking, basically the kind of staccato movements of the eyes, little micro movements that they do as they're kind of making small adjustments when they're looking at something. That comes from that tracking data, and it's a really important component to getting that sense of the character taking in the environment around him and looking and learning. And so that comes directly from that. But like you say, it's difficult to get those precise eyelid shapes and brow shapes from the motion capture data. So we can derive some information from that, but we still have to have a facial rig, essentially like an animation puppet, that will be able to get into those shapes. And that's one of the processes that we could go through on every film, and certainly that was true on this film, where you'll start with some design concepts, and the studio in this case was quite committed to them, the director was committed to them, and we built this initial Caesar design, and then we started animating on it. We found that actually the brows, for example, were a bit too thick and too simple in a way. We didn't have enough detail in them. And the eyelids, while they were, the upper lids in particular, while they were realistic compared to some chimpanzees, they didn't have as close of a correspondence to your typical chimpanzee, and also to Andy Serkis. One of the things that helps a lot is any detail that we can take from a performer and sneak into the design of the character helps a lot in terms of being able to match those facial expressions. And certainly the case in Avatar with Jake and Neytiri, we were taking a lot of that detail directly from the actors that were playing those characters. On Caesar, it's a little trickier because he's a chimpanzee and he has to look like a chimpanzee. So we spent a lot of time studying real chimpanzees and seeing like what ways we could still get a little bit of Andy in there without making it look like it's, you know, not a chimpanzee, still keeping it in that world. And the upper lids in particular and the brows were two of the areas that were really important. And then once we'd done that, we were able to match a lot more closely the shapes and get a puppet to do what Andy's face was naturally inclined to do.
Because Andrew Leslie didn't give you many places to hide. I mean, are there any points that you went, man, I didn't think we were going to have this many close-ups?
No, to be honest, like the close-ups, I think, help a lot. Certainly, for us, we knew the film was gonna live or die based on that close-up. If the audience was gonna connect with Caesar, they had to be able to look at him in detail and really believe him as a character. So we put a lot of our energy into making sure that those close-ups worked. You know, in some cases, at the expense a little bit of the wide shots. You only have so much time and so many resources to you have to choose your battles. And it was a decision we made on Avatar, and it was a decision we made on Rise of the Apes as well. If we could really sell the close-ups, people would forgive, what might be, slight imperfections in some of the wider shots.
And we've talked a bit about Caesar, but obviously there are other species of primates in the film. The gorillas and the orangutans, for example, I mean, do their eyes differ? I mean, how much were you able to use the same eye approach for the different species or even the different apes?
It's a good thing I'm glad you brought that up, because that's definitely one thing that, we had to make a decision about in terms of how close the apes' eyes were going to be to one another and how close they were going to be to humans as well. We found working on King Kong that, when you look at the footage in the wild and footage in the zoos of gorillas and chimpanzees, you'll see that they're the scleras, the white areas on a human's eye, on apes tend to be darker. Like in some cases they're almost black, in other cases they're like a very kind of dark pink, and the irises tend to be more of an orange kind of color. And that can be a little bit tricky, especially for a character like Kong, where the eyes are fairly hooded and fairly deep set. It makes it difficult to read which direction the eyes are looking. So on Kong, we decided to take a little bit of artistic license, and we made those the scleras with a little bit lighter, a little bit closer to human eyes than what you would normally have. With Planet of the Apes, what we did was we started the film using eyes that were very close to ape eyes. So if you watch the opening sequence of the film where they're still in Africa and the apes are being caught by the poachers, you'll see that there's a couple close-ups where you'll see very clearly that we've got that classic ape eye with the orange iris and the very dark pink, almost black sclera around the eye, and quite a bit more realistic to what you'll see in the zoo. As we get further into the film, part of one of the story points is that the eyes change, and they talk about these flecks of green that develop in the eyes. At the same time, we changed the scleras to be a bit lighter as well, brought them closer to your human eye, and it just allows you to read the eye direction a little bit better, and also it gives you a little bit more of a human connection with those characters. So that was, that was one thing that that we played with to try to get a slightly better, connection with the audience. Between the gorillas and the orangutans, it was more or less the same kind of thing. While we did have different textures and they varied subtly, it's not like the orangutans, for example, had a radically different eye. They were still quite similar to what we were doing on the chimpanzees.
But orangutans' eyes are pretty much dark across, right? I mean, in and then you've got sort of obviously, well, depending on the species of ape, you've also got the kind of an eyebrow thing. Was there a problem with just losing the eyes into a shadow of a socket and therefore losing the performance?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a challenge on the orangutans, like you mentioned. They have a rounder eye, and the opening of their eyelid is a little bit smaller as well, so you tend to just see iris and not a whole lot of the sclera of the eye, and that can be challenging. But yeah, it's just something that we tend to deal with on a shot-by-shot basis, and just make sure that the eyes are legible and then that the brows read clearly. And that's, you know, one thing as well that we find with, depending on the lighting as well, if you have a more underlit shot, you can lose the brows a little bit more as well. And you just keep an eye on it and adjust as you need to.
I'm a huge fan of Andrew Leslie. I think he's a great DOP. I'm wondering, if you're in a shot of Caesar and you've got Andy Serkis there obviously giving a performance, how much is Andrew Leslie lighting Andy Serkis, and are you sort of trying to get an HDR at that spot, or are you more sort of saying, look, if there was an orangutan there, Andrew would come in and light him, but there isn't, and we're not, for time reasons, so we're not going to get too specific on the exact sort of HDR sampling at that point, because let's face it, Andrew didn't light a hero, you know, if it had been an actor there, he'd have lit hero actor lighting on them.
Yeah, Andrew was quite detailed with the lighting. I mean, he was essentially lighting Andy as if Andy was, you know, was the character for the film. So we tried to stay as close to that as we could. We took essentially HDR fisheye, you know, 360 degree light probes of, you know, the position where Caesar would be standing. A lot of times we take them from other positions where, you know, other background apes would be standing as well. And we also took reference photos of the general lighting setups because, you know, while those light probes are quite useful in a lot of cases, we invariably end up replacing sections of them because the characters will move through the space. And, you know, if you try to use a light probe directly, an image-based light, it kind of presupposes that all the light is coming, you know, in the same way to each spot on the character that's being shaded. And as the character moves through the space, that's obviously not true. So we'll end up replacing, you know, some of the lights with more kind of traditional area lights or spotlights, and so we'll take a more of a survey kind of photograph of the lighting setup as well, and get a better idea of how things were actually physically laid out, so that it's not more clear what was actually going on there. And certainly, you know, Andrew was quite meticulous about how he was lighting those characters, and we tried to match that as much as we were able to.
The which brings us, I guess, to the fur on the, because obviously, not pointing to any particular scene, but you might want to have backlighting to sort of highlight hair, especially on the younger apes. They get this kind of fuzz kind of fur that really responds to backlight and stuff. I'm wondering, did you do any considerations for lighting for what would be coming in? Because obviously Andy Serkis isn't as hairy as an ape. And, you know, you obviously want to get a sheen on the fur because it, you know, it would look nice and be appropriate.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, lighting fur is a little bit different than lighting, you know, skin. Like you say, depending on the orientation of the head, and how long or short they are, and how transparent they are, what color they are, the light changes. So we certainly wouldn't give ourselves some license to either add a few additional accent lights or change slightly the position of the key light in some cases in order to get a better highlight or a better edge on the character. And a lot of times we were looking more at the result on Andy than the actual physical position of the light. Certainly gave ourselves room to deviate from where the lights actually were in order to get an image that looked more like the way that Andy was being lit.
So if I could switch gears just now away from the face to the hands, the reason I want to do that is it just struck me that there's a property of Caesar's hands now when he's older, obviously. They seem really beautifully leathery, wonderfully textured, but also it struck me that they didn't seem to have a lot of subsurface scattering like you might get obviously with his ears, which are protruding. And I'm wondering, were there any tricks to get that wonderful realistic texture, because the leathery kind of nature of his hands didn't seem to indicate that you were going to get that from just, say, subsurface scattering. Was there any sort of tricks going on there?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there's any tricks really, so much as just sort of careful balancing of the parameters. We use kind of a unified skin shading model, so the same shader that's being applied to his face is being applied to his hands.
Oh, really?
But the parameters are being adjusted through through the map, the texture maps, basically. And we'll set up regions, and we'll make corrections based on different regions as well. So, you know, while we're using the same shader, we're able to get a variety of different kind of results out of it. One of the things that we spent a lot of time on was getting the displacement maps, you know, as good as we could on the hands. And as you know, the fine displacement and adjustments to displacement will change your perception of the surface qualities of an object quite a bit, and the way that the highlight gets broken up and how rough or smooth the object feels. One thing that we like to do, Gino Esteva is our kind of the head of our textures department. He has a long history in prosthetics, and he has it's like a library of different casts and pieces of silicone skin and texture that he's taken from all sorts of different people in different places. And we take these like silicone skin pieces and put them in a vat of oil on top of a flatbed scanner, and we'll scan those physical pieces, which are basically they're like the negatives off of the back of somebody's hand or somebody's elbow or somebody's face.
I saw a presentation done on that at SIDGRAPH Asia, and I was really impressed with that, both the technology of how thin they were and then, of course, how well they flattened out in that oil to give you a really good reading on the flatbed. But if I could be, I guess, again, naive question, but it just struck me that I could easily imagine you asking an actor to sit still while you cast their hand. It just didn't seem like you get a chimp to sit still while you cast their hand.
Yeah, they pretty much have to be sedated. One of the things, we had a really good relationship with the Wellington Zoo, and they've got a great troop of about a dozen chimpanzees that have a lot of personality and a lot of, and the viewing platform at the Wellington Zoo is such that you can get a really good look at them without any kind of obstruction between you and them. There's no glass and no bars, and you can really just kind of study and watch them. And also, you occasionally have to go in for medical procedures, and there've been a couple times when they've let us know, you know, when they're going to put a chimp under, and we've been able to get in and get a really good photo reference and also cast a hand or a foot and get good data of that while they were getting the, you know, whatever medical thing done that they needed to have done. And it's, you know, it's the kind of detail and the information that you get out of those kind of sessions is just incredible, you know, just to be able to photograph that stuff up close and take casts. The other thing we use is a company called Bone Clones a lot. They've got, in addition to casts of skeletons of apes and humans and other animals, they've also got a library of casts of hands and feet of various primates. In some cases, they're taken from after the animal has passed away, which is a little unfortunate because the skin will start to take on a slightly different character, especially if they've been dead for a little while. But it's still a whole lot better than trying to invent it from, you know, thin air.
Okay, so, I mean, Bone Clones, I've been to their site. I know you can buy, for example, a skull, a plaster skull of a gorilla or whatever.
You can buy a cast of a gorilla skull. You can buy a cast of an orangutan skull. You can buy a cast of an orangutan hand. And you can buy a whole skeleton. It's a fantastic place. We have a lot. We've got a full set of human, gorilla, orangutan, and chimpanzee skeletons. We've got quite a few skulls kind of floating around, a whole lot of hands and feet, and then Gino has a wall of, I guess, probably about 100 different human faces, heads that he's cast over the years, and then, you know, a library of different skin negatives that have been taken off of those casts that we use for pore maps and wrinkle maps, people of all different ages and, you know, genders and races, and it's fantastic reference.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from my point of view, like most people think of a chimpanzee, you know, you've seen them in sort of 60s sitcoms trying to do various things, but they're pretty, but actually they're really strong and incredibly dangerous creatures. But that said, they can be trained and obviously are highly intelligent. Was there any sort of thought of actually using a real chimp for any of the sequences, or real apes for any of the sequences?
Not really. I mean, chimps in the entertainment industry are pretty much, they can't be used past the age of about 5. So that's why you know, the chimps that you see in commercials and old television shows and things, they always look pretty small and pretty young. And once they get to be about five, they're too strong to be handled by humans. And so they're just not workable. The other thing is that, the success of the film was going to hinge on the performance of that chimp, that character Caesar. And if Caesar was played by a chimp, it would be very difficult to get a convincing performance, you know, out of him in terms of like the emotional arc that he needed to go through. And it's preferable for so many reasons to work with a human actor that's, you know, an experienced actor who knows how to go through that process. And, you know, there's really no better person for this kind of work than Andy Serkis. We worked with him a lot in the past, and when we started talking to Fox about working on this project, we said that would be, you know, the ideal situation. If you could get Andy, if Andy was interested in this project, he would be the perfect person to play Caesar. Well, you know, apart from just having spent a lot of time around primates, he's familiar with performance capture technology, and he's just a great actor. He's got an amazingly expressive face. He gives a whole lot to his performances. He really commits and unambiguous in terms of what he's going through emotionally. And you know when you see him in a scene, and it's just a fantastic guy to work with.
And Andy actually had a team, didn't he? Because as you mentioned, they were up to eight. So there was like a bunch of guys with Buck and Alpha did you use a puppet for baby Caesar at some point? But I think the others were all motion captured, right?
Well, I'll just back up a little bit. We definitely worked with a team of performers that played other apes. Terry Notary, he worked on the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. He's also worked on several other films, including Avatar. He's kind of a movement specialist. He's sometimes does stunt work, but he comes from a gymnastics background. He worked in some of the first Cirque du Soleil troops, and he's just got an incredible athleticism and understanding of the way that primates move. And so he worked with a team of stuntmen and other performers and kind of trained them up on, kind of put them through an ape school at the beginning of the project to get them to be able to move and behave like apes. And then from there, the director cast a few of those apes for kind of primary roles, and then a few of those apes for kind of more secondary roles, and that kind of gave us our kind of base troop of apes for the film. But yet, so for the baby Caesar, there was a animatronic puppet that really didn't get used for any place where you saw his face. You know, we had a digital infant Caesar. That the animatronic basically just had a little bit of jaw movement and some eye blinks and head turn. In fact, actually, it may not have even had jaw movement. I think it may have just been eye blinks and head turns. So it really didn't have the ability to put in much of an emotional, you know, in terms of making a performance. It was really more of a lighting stand-in, an object for the actors to react to. There are a handful of shots that made it into the film where you see kind of the back of its head, and it's just a little furry tuft sticking out of some blankets. But any time where you really see the infant acting, that's the digital character.
Well, I just, you know, I think obviously there's a lot of performance from Andy Serkis, but also from your team. And quite frankly, you know, obviously it's not a silent film, as you said, but really so much of the acting does come from the eyes. So I just want to thank you so much for, you know, talking to us about that and explaining. It's been really brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thanks, guys. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. As I mentioned, we just finished SIGGRAPH, and John and I are heading over to IBC to see a bunch of our European friends in the next coming early September that happens. So we'll have a lot of coverage from there as well. We usually end up getting some great content, especially in-depth Nuke stuff from the Foundry folks while we're over there. So you'll be keeping an eye out for that. And like I said, check out the SIGGRAPH coverage over on fxguide.com. All right, for my partners John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to seagraph.org/Asia2011.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.